Hello, Treaders, or also hello to any new listeners. Thank you for coming back to listen to us, or thank you for coming for the first time to listen to us. I'm co-host and running coach Laura of Laura Norris Running.
And I'm co-host and running coach Amanda Brooks of Run to the Finish. I had to pause there. Who am I today?
And we wear so many different hats.
So true.
We are excited to have you on the Tread Lightly podcast today, and we are doing another re-record of one of our earlier episodes. This is a re-record of our episode on marathon pacing strategies. We have learned a lot about audio and editing since then, and I think this will bring a more pleasant listener experience. Plus, we have some added info. So this is like marathon pacing strategies, Tread Lightly version.
Thanks to all of you who stuck with us through our early days. Listen, we're doing this on a bootstrap, no money kind of budget, so we appreciate it. All right, listener question from Steven. The latest episode of Tread Lightly was really great. Thank you. I continue to very much enjoy your format and episode length. One topic that I think might be fun is your preference or thoughts on races with a larger field versus a smaller field. Do you have a preference, pros, cons?
That's a great question. And it's funny because this came from an athlete of mine, but then I had other athletes of mine asking literally the exact same question the week of our recording. I'm going to be like difficult here, but I'm a solidly medium-sized race person. I don't want it so small that there's no spectators and I'm running alone and I'm wondering what I even – like why I'm even there when it's hard, because we all have those thoughts. But I don't like it so large that I feel like locked in and congested. I feel like my ideal race size is like the 1,000 to 2,000 runners size. What about you?
See, I would consider that a small race.
True. you can tell I used to live in Indiana.
Yeah. I swing a little on this because I've done like Miami, where I just felt like I was getting elbowed for the majority of the race because it was so packed. Well, it was so packed until you get to 13 miles and then everyone disappears and suddenly you're all by yourself. So I've had a couple marathons like that. Same thing. I did Las Vegas Rock and Roll the first year, so it was still in the morning. And I didn't like that once the half marathoners left, I was pretty much running by myself. And to maintain like a PR goal pace with no one around you is really, really difficult. So I do kind of like the bigger races, the Chicago's, New York would be fine if I didn't have to wait at the start line so long. if I can find one that's like a little smaller, or the ones where it's a marathon only or a half marathon only, then it's kind of nice because you're like, oh, even if the field is smaller, like everyone's doing it. So with the 10Ks I've done, yeah, they've probably been, like you said, more like 2,000 people. But everyone is staying, so I'm going to have people around the whole race, and I like that.
Yeah. And I will say, like, the one thing I can give smaller races, having done some and knowing the person who wrote in this question, is, like, sometimes it can give you an opportunity to win your age group or even place overall. Like, I did once a pretty small race in Seattle, and I think like originally I got second place, but then they realized the person with first didn't like properly fill out her information. So that like sometimes affects your ability to win. But like they held out the tape for me and I was like, I would never get to do this at a big marathon it was a 10K, a big race, but it was kind of a cool advantage of a small race. That said, I was pushing for a 10K PR by myself, not racing anyone, for the final 2 miles. And that was so hard. So I think it's kind of like weighing what sort of experience you want.
That's so true. My last 10K PR, I was the first female. And so I won overall, but that's because it was a very small race. So it was harder to keep pushing. But the other thing I will say for smaller races is you don't have to get there so early. I'm not so worried about parking. It's really easy to just get in, get out. And sometimes, depending on where you're at, you can really maybe enjoy the location a little bit more sometimes. So there are definitely benefits. So I think it comes down to, like you said, what am I trying to get out of the day? What matters most to me about this race? Is it one that's just going to be like fun and more chill, or, you know, kind of what are you looking for?
Yeah. And I think also, like, kind of to this listener, it's okay to like try different things and change your mind. Like, I've gone through phases of loving smaller local races, and then I've gone through phases of being like, if I'm going to do a marathon, I want a well-sized, organized event like CIM or something where it's going to be very streamlined and I'm never going to run alone. And we all go through different eras of our running.
All right. Let's talk marathon pacing. What do we actually need to do to run our best marathon time? Do we need to negative split, positive split, even split? What in the world does all of that even mean?
Yeah, it's interesting how used to our own jargon we get as runners. And then you work with a new runner and they're like, what the heck do you mean by that? So just as a quick, like, overview, a negative split means that the second half was faster than the first half. A positive split is the opposite. The first half is faster than the second half. That's a very common experience in a marathon if you hit the wall and bonk and slow down. Even splits are like you're just metronoming your way through. And like when we see like peak world records, sometimes they're even split, sometimes they're slightly negative split.
Yeah, I'd love to see the data from the most recent trials, but there was data from the 2016 Olympic marathon trials, and there were 108 men who finished, 149 women who finished, and only 7 of them ran negative splits. One of them was Meb, and he was only a negative split by 44 seconds. So I think when we're seeing that what the elites are trying to do is run even from the beginning to the end, it's a good note for all of us to kind of pay attention to, that even if they're thinking about a negative split, they're thinking minute negative split. A lot of times I will see people have a race plan where they're looking to gain minutes in the second half and not sort of accounting for the fatigue and everything that rolls in the second half.
Yeah. Oh, like when you think about minutes over, say, like 13.1 halves of a marathon, like that's several tens of seconds per mile faster. And like, I just feel like that's asking a lot. Like, I'm a huge fan of controlled starts, but that doesn't mean that you're going to reach mile 20 and all of a sudden crank it up by 30 seconds per mile.
Yeah, which I think is exactly what a lot of people have kind of in their head, is that, okay, yeah, I'm going to start out at my goal or close to it, but then I'm going to hit that point and I'm really going to like lay it down. And that can happen sometimes, but generally aiming for an even pace from start to finish is going to be your most ideal strategy. Now, we'll talk a little bit more about more course specific type things. But in general, try to look at your race that way. How close can I get to my goal and pretty much stay right on that?
Yeah. And I think it's worth noting for people listening that an even split in terms of pacing might feel like a negative split in terms of effort, because like you mentioned, of how fatigue works, like you're naturally going to get more tired as you go and your effort's going to be higher. On the flip side, like the first half of a marathon might feel almost downright boring if you try to even split it properly. So the effort feels really easy.
Yes. And I think that's huge, right? That you want the first half of your marathon not to feel hard. If it feels hard in the first half, you're in for some pain in the second half.
Yes, yes, I've been there. And it's like you look back in retrospect and you're like, I should have slowed down sooner because it would have saved a greater slowdown later.
So one of the other big things that we see, particularly in fall marathons, is that weather can have a really big impact on our race day. There is some interesting information kind of around ideal race performance weather.
Yeah. So there is one study of major marathons and elite performances that showed that 39 to 49 degrees Fahrenheit or 3.8 to 9.9 degrees Celsius resulted in the best marathon performance. And on either side outside that range, so colder or warmer, resulted in a decline in finish times and performance.
I think that's interesting because people tend to only think about the heat, but realizing that, yes, the cold weather can also create an impact in performance loss.
It can. And like, you can go back and listen to our episode on cold weather running for a little bit more on that. But like, if it's too cold, it impairs your muscle function. And that impaired muscle function isn't exactly like optimal for a fast marathon.
One of the other things to take into account really is humidity. So particularly when you're running a warm weather marathon, there's some interesting things just around how that changes your heart rate. So your heart rate can increase up to 10 beats per minute in humidity ranging from 50 to 90%. So 50% isn't crazy high, but when you add in some heat to that, think if you're starting the race and your heart rate is already 10 beats higher than normal, that means your effort is going to feel significantly harder the longer and longer that you run. Additionally, we'll see things like your heart rate can increase 2 to 4 beats per minute in temperatures from 60 to 75 degrees Fahrenheit, or up to 10 beats per minute in temperatures from 75 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So again, sort of combining all of that together, you're going to have to adjust your race strategy because your body is simply working harder.
Oh yeah. Like, there's a lot of work going on to not having heat stroke. And again, like you said, it's not just the heat, but it's the humidity. So sometimes even if it's in that ideal temperature range, but it's a very muggy, humid 40 degree day, that can still slow you down because your like sweat rate and the way like sweat helps you cool down is not going to be as efficient. So the dew point can be a helpful technical measure of how much water is in the air. So can wet bulb global temperature, but apps don't really give that. And I know you have a really helpful dew point chart on your website.
Yeah. And I know I've shared this in a couple different places. So kind of figuring out that dew point number, and then you can look at the chart and see sort of, okay, how much do I need to adjust my goal pace, or how much is this potentially going to affect me? And I know I've seen some people say things like, just ignore it and just stick to your goal. And I get it. Like, we don't want to tell you that like your goal is no longer possible, but I also want to set you up for the best possible day. And if that means being a little more conservative to start so that you don't have a complete blow up later, as a coach, that's what I want to see.
And, you know, from working with hundreds of athletes, I've had so many athletes say like eventually reach the point where they're like, I would rather be a couple minutes slower than my goal and feel good and strong during the race than to maybe even actually hit my goal but have a horrible time and feel like garbage the whole time. Like, I know that PRs are important, but there is also just how do you feel during the race? And I feel like really crummy feeling races just aren't a great experience.
Yeah, I think my marathon PR is from New York and I had the worst experience. I basically had hypothermia when I finished. And so I would have rather just enjoyed the entire day because everyone says New York is amazing and I don't have that feeling.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's really something to consider. Now, in terms of like if it is hot and humid, this approach does not entirely offset the impact of heat and humidity, but can help. And it's one of those like buzzing fields in exercise science, but it's the idea of what they call cooling techniques, both pre and mid. A 2015 review in the British Journal of Sports Medicine found a 5.7% and 9.9% improvements with pre and mid cooling, respectively. And we've seen that in real life at things like the more recent Western states when it's been like record-breaking heat sometimes. And it's just this idea that before the race and during, you do things to try to bring down your core temperature. Maybe you drink an ice cold drink before, during the race, you dump some cold water from the aid stations on your head and neck. We saw that a lot at the Olympic trials in Orlando recently.
Yep. And we've seen it with like the Tour de France riders. They'll be wearing those ice vests during their warm up. Or we saw that in, I believe, the Tokyo Olympics, where they were wearing ice vests and things like that beforehand, kind of doing everything they can. And this is going back to that idea of, can we at least start with your heart rate more normal instead of already elevated before you even start putting in the work?
Just thinking off that, popped in my head, a question I've heard sometimes from athletes is, should your entire pacing plan be based off heart rate, or should it be based off pace or effort? Because I know we're talking about how like heart rate changes in the heat, and that's something to take into account. But should you have like a set heart rate for a marathon?
I think that's a great question. I'm someone who likes to train by heart rate for easy stuff, but come race day, I don't care what that number is. I want to know how I feel. And if you've practiced tapping into sort of what is my effort level in training, then you have a better chance in those early miles of sort of knowing, like, does this feel the way I expect it to feel, or does this already feel harder than I thought it would?
Yeah, I agree. Because like, especially, it's not just weather that can spike your heart rate. Race day excitement and nerves can spike your heart rate. If you're taking caffeine before the race for a performance enhancement, that can really spike your heart rate. So sometimes some athletes, even in perfectly mild conditions, will get to the start line and have like a heart rate of like 110 beats per minute just standing there.
Yep, those are great reminders. So another one, though, we kind of mentioned early on was, how does the course impact your strategy? So Chicago, Berlin, some of these that are relatively flat, that's where, you know, it becomes really easy to kind of have that even pacing strategy or something that's consistently rolling throughout. But when you've got Boston, or you've got something like a Revel race with just a super long downhill, then you have to have more of an actual plan. So it's less of find my pace and just hold it, and a little bit more of, you know, how am I working with the course? So knowing that there are big hills later in Boston, but there's some early big downhills, there's kind of finding control in both of those places to help even out your pace.
Yes, because so many athletes will get to those Revel races, and they can start really steep for some of them, where you almost have like no control at all because of how steep it is. And sometimes those athletes will just start bombing down like a minute per mile faster than marathon pace because it feels easy in the moment.
Yes, I've definitely seen that a number of times. And I think it's still surprising to people how intense a downhill race can be on your body. And even though it feels easier in some way, you're still asking your body to move faster than you've practiced doing for such a long period of time. And if you are cranking your heart rate up a little bit faster right at the very beginning, you're immediately consuming carbs a lot faster. So your fueling needs have actually gone up because you're asking more of your body so quickly.
Yes. And those downhill races, like, they beat up your body so bad. Like, people are sometimes like, oh, do downhill PRs count at all? And that's a debate for a different day. But like, maybe you could argue they're metabolically a little easier to start, but muscularly, they're going to rip you to shreds so much sooner than something like, say, Chicago.
Oh, for sure. So what do you tell your athletes who are kind of looking for a strategy for Boston?
Yeah. So usually what we do at Boston, and Boston has the benefit of like a little bit more congestion at the start of the race that can help people rein it in. But usually we talk about like letting the first few miles make marathon pace feel super, super easy. So sometimes I'll even have the athletes like check their pace half a mile in, and again, you know, a mile in, just to make sure they're not going too fast down those initial downhills. And then it's just about like sticking to pace, not banking time, and really just thinking of it as an opportunity to, like you said, ease in effort-wise, let your heart rate be a little lower for a while, burn a little bit fewer carbs early on so that when they do have to push, they have the resources to. It also mitigates muscle damage to do that. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of like you said, it's it's one where you need to play a little bit more of a game of holding back on a downhill and then being prepared to kind of know, okay, when I get to a steep uphill, my pace might slow down a little bit. So I want to focus on just maintaining the same effort level going up and then the same effort level going down. So you can kind of just even out that pace.
Oh yeah, absolutely. What about for like a downhill race like Rebel? How would you give an athlete some guides on pacing through that when there's no uphills to kind of stop their roll?
Yeah, that one is a little tougher. I will kind of try to look at some of those, like you said, and see what the grade is. So are there really steep portions versus portions that are just a little more gradual? And again, try to figure out how do we not overrun the steep portions. So allowing your body to move without putting the brakes on, but not too much. So, okay, maybe you got 20 seconds faster, but as soon as you got off that really steep part, you immediately pulled it back. And then maybe even had like a little bit slower in the next mile to just kind of regroup or something like that. So even mostly is what we're going to be looking at, unless you've got a couple of those sections that are really steep. And then it's this weird combo of, I don't want you breaking because that's hard on the body, but I don't want you just letting it fly, like you said, and being a minute too fast. So trying to find that balance in the middle.
Oh, it's such a tricky balance. And that's, I think, where doing a few like downhill long runs in training can really help. Like you have a very quick repeated bout effect with downhill and the eccentrics, where even just one or two long runs on the downhills can help you like muscularly adapt to them, but it can also help you feel more confident about how to pace them while maintaining good form.
I am a huge, huge proponent of trying to do long runs that are similar to where you're racing. I've talked about that many times with Chicago. People don't totally agree with me all the time, but Chicago has like 200 feet over 26 miles, and that is flat. So if your long runs are consistently having 800, 900, 1,000 feet, you're used to rolling hills. You aren't used to what it feels like to try and maintain a steady pace with no change in muscle usage. And that is a very different thing. Or like you said, if you're doing a downhill race, getting that appropriate, what does this feel like to simply be going with those muscles working the whole time?
And those are harder long runs than I think people give them credit for. Then there's the topic of fueling considerations around pacing. So if you've been listening to this podcast for any amount of time, you know we're huge proponents of adequately fueling a marathon. But are there special considerations we can take to help our fueling strategy complement our pacing strategy?
We definitely have a full episode talking all about fueling, but there are just a couple things that I do like to sort of talk with my athletes about. And one is, if you do have a race with some big hills in it, if you try taking some carbs shortly before those big hills are coming, it's kind of just like topping off the tank. It's this nice little boost. It's also literally telling your brain that energy is coming in as soon as that is in your mouth. And so that can be a little bit of an energy boost. Caffeine intake, thinking about the idea that it takes 45 minutes for it to really peak in your system. So timing when you want to use that in the race is also really beneficial. So you may sort of realize you like to take it about halfway, or you may like to take it a little earlier. But that's, again, something kind of practice in your long runs to see, where do I want to use that? Some folks can use caffeine multiple times in a race. That feels like a GI disaster for me, since I don't drink caffeine. So I time one thing with caffeine for the maximum boost.
Yeah. Not every gel should be a caffeinated gel like that. I feel like the recommendations are like 3 to 5 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. And so if you're taking like one of those more than 100 milligram of caffeine gels 5 times across the marathon, you're surpassing those recommendations, and it might not play out well.
I think the last one is just to take an extra gel when you're getting close to the finish, it's one of the things that I think a lot of us make the mistake of is we start getting in the last few miles. And even though timing wise, we should take something, we'll mentally say like, but I'm almost done. Instead of saying, oh, I need this to ensure that I can keep going and finish strong. So take that gel. Don't be afraid to even take a little bit extra, maybe even if it wasn't like it's a little bit early. Take it, get that fuel in so that you can have every possible advantage of finishing strong.
So then another question I hear often from people about, you know, marathon pacing strategies, and we kind of saw this in the Olympic trials with Fiona O'Keefe's performance, is if you're feeling really, really good, when can you start just kind of abandoning your pacing strategy and pushing a little bit harder? And I know she broke off from the pack early, but, you know, she's obviously incredibly, incredibly talented.
Interesting, because I happened to be at Puma, which is her sponsor, with her family. And one of the things they were talking about for her is that when she was in track, she knew she was always going to get outkicked. So short distances, she was not the winner. She always got outkicked. And so I think she genuinely had a strategy here that she didn't want it come down to a final kick. She wanted there to be enough of a gap that she didn't have to worry about that, which is interesting. Yeah, what's your take on that? When do you kind of say, okay, you're feeling strong, you can let it rip?
So I do base it off of the athlete's experience level and the course profile. So for some very experienced marathoners, you know, they've done a few, who are also running a course that is conducive to a push, like something like CIM where it's flat, Chicago, Berlin, but not something like New York, for example, where, you know, you come across the Central Park Hills relatively soon in the final 10K. But for more experienced athletes, and if the course permits, I'll say around mile 20 is when you can just start pushing a little bit more and more each mile, take advantage of feeling good. For more difficult courses or for athletes with less marathon experience, that might wait until mile 22 to 23, especially if it's like your first marathon, you might feel pretty good at mile 20 and then it all hits you at mile 23. So we don't want to get too greedy. What about you?
I think the point you made about pushing it a little bit is kind of the key. So it's not, okay, you hit mile 20, you feel pretty good and you can like drop 30 seconds per mile. But I think in our heads, that's exactly what we're like, oh, okay, if I'm going to go faster, then I'm going to go faster. It's surprising how much that jump, which can sound so small, 30 seconds can sound so small when you're thinking about a 4-hour race, but it's a lot in your per mile time. So really and truly, I love that idea of sort of, okay, maybe at 20, you take it down 5 seconds and like, okay, at 21, at 22, how are you feeling? And like you said, if you have a lot of experience, you could be sort of tweaking just a little bit with each of those, but you really have to be so in tune with how's my hydration, how's my fueling, and genuinely how do my legs feel. If you start cranking it down and then all of a sudden what felt like a level, you know, 7-8 effort is now consistently an 8, maybe leaning into a 9, like I'd rather we back off then suddenly get to 25 and now you can't even hold the original pace because we just went too hard.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point because you don't want to hit like your lactate threshold with, you know, 50 minutes left of your marathon to go. You're not going to be able to sustain that with that much fatigue. And that's where I do think we've talked about like fast finish long runs a lot over past episodes. And I think that's where those type of training runs can be really beneficial. A lot of my marathoners are familiar with these, but there can be a variation of that where it's like long runs that finish at marathon pace to teach you how marathon pace feels when you're kind of tired. And maybe like experienced athletes could have like the last mile 5 seconds faster or something. But if it's something that you mimic in training, then on race day, you kind of know where your limits are and how to make those small adjustments in pace.
What are some things you like to do to help people figure out a realistic marathon pace?
Yeah. So there's a couple strategies I take. One is we look at marathon pace workouts and training, especially if the athlete is in tune with their effort enough to keep the workouts honest. And I think in like the gray zone episode, we talked a bit, like some of my marathoners do pretty big workouts with like 10 miles at marathon pace where they can't fake their way through it or race those. And we usually like discard any anomaly horrible workouts where, you know, they slept poorly the night before and had a bad workout before that. And then we take the average of those. Sometimes also if we've had a tune-up race recently, like a really solid tune-up half marathon, or if we've done like a 10K time trial and training recently, we'll use that to look at pace. Now that all said, like usually if I'm putting in a tune-up race into like the VDOT calculator, I add like 3 to 7 minutes to the time that the Jack Daniels calculator spits out, because it's based off like elite runners who tend to have a smaller gap between shorter distances in the marathon. And it's always better to be conservative. What about you?
Yeah, I think even with the Garmin predictions, it for the majority of people is faster than what I see them doing on race day. And so I try to take those with a grain of salt. I like to take other races, or even if you're brand new and this is your first marathon, kind of depending on how training has been going and how strong you've been feeling, race day, you may still be 10 seconds, maybe 20 seconds per mile faster because you've got the adrenaline, the excitement, taper, all of that sort of stuff. You may be exactly at your normal easy pace. But for runners who have had just a really strong training cycle, that can be kind of a gauge, sort of that 10 to 20 seconds for your very first. Again, ideally, you will have had a half marathon or something else that we could really for sure base it on. But if we don't have any of that, that's kind of where I might start.
Yeah. I think that goes to show the value of racing other distances before you race your first marathon, or if it's been a while since you've raced a marathon.
And it's another chance to work through the nerves and the even pacing and all of that good stuff too.
Absolutely. So then as we reach the end, you know, I think another thing athletes ask a lot is, how do I stay on pace when I experience mental and physical fatigue?
There's so much to the mental side of things. One of the things that works well for a lot of people, honestly, is following a pace group. So you just have other people around that are putting in that same level of effort. And it can be easier to simply decide mentally, I am going to hang on to these people, whatever happens. I will play games with myself towards the end of a race. So early on, I will be thinking, as everyone is passing me, because I am starting out at my steady pace, I'm going to catch you later. That's what I will tell myself. And then when I'm getting towards the end where everything is tired and I want to slow down so badly, I will pick out someone in front of me and be like, okay, red shirt. I'm going to catch the red shirt. And so that it just shifts you a little bit out of what you're thinking about your body to something external. And other random things that work, literally smiling, saying thank you to the police officers or thank you to the spectators, it genuinely works. Like there's chemicals happening in your brain. So that's a couple little mental things.
I think those are really, I mean, that's kind of what I tell my athletes also. I've had some people take the strategy where if like they love running to music, they'll save music for when they begin to feel like they need to push. Again, like you said, it kind of takes them out of their own head a little bit. And instead of having negative thoughts, they're distracted by their music. The higher upbeat helps them pick up their cadence when fatigued. Obviously, you always want to check rules of the race. And then the other thing I go to is throw a gel at it, like bring an extra gel or two. And if you start to feel like you want to slow down, just throw some extra carbs at it. At the very least, it's going to give your brain a boost, like we said earlier.
I love the music one. I didn't even think about that. I do that in most races. I like having my headphones in because it makes me feel like I'm concentrating. But I won't turn them on until late in the race. And it is an immediate like, kind of a shift. So that's a great reminder. Great tip.
Oh yeah. It's not, it was one some of my athletes had, so I can't take credit for it. It's one I picked up from them. So we're nearing the end of this episode. Is there anything you want to leave listeners with?
The only other thing would be, don't be too tied to your watch. So I really do think learning how to run by effort is so key. Some people can run much faster than anticipated when they lean into effort and stop freaking out about their pace, or just have an overall better day when it's not your primary thing that you're checking all the time. So really, really, really practice effort levels in your training and getting used to what the heck does it mean to run at different efforts and how does that feel?
Oh yeah, 100%. And like with that, for some of my athletes who have struggled with marathon pacing, we do more marathon pace workouts, especially in like the final 8 to 10 weeks before the race. So if like you're listening to this and you've never done a large chunk of marathon pace workouts, do them. And like Amanda said, focus on your effort during them. Do them honest, not trying to hit a pace, because that way it's one less thing you have to think about on race day.
And listen, people may not love the treadmill like I do, but I am a steady, steady pacer because of my treadmill miles.
Oh yeah, there can be a time where it is such a helpful tool. Like if you struggle to actually control yourself at marathon pace, get on the treadmill, set it to, you know, an approximate marathon pace and learn what it feels like to stay at that pace.
All right, runners, thanks for joining us once again. Please make sure you take just a couple seconds to drop a rating, to subscribe, to share an episode with a friend.
And we love hearing from all of you. We appreciate your listener questions. So find us on Instagram at @treadlightlyrunning. Give us a follow. And if you have any questions you want to hear on episodes, shoot us a DM there.